The title of my message is After the Miracles. There's been a question that I have had and intrigued me for some time. It's not a simple question. It's not a controversial question. It has to do with biblical history and a very, very famous story, one you're very well aware of. But the analysis of it in the Bible, in a certain section, polarizes many people. It polarizes Jews and Christians. It even polarizes Christians. Again, it's not controversial, and it's a story that is in the Old Testament, but it is referenced in the New. And Paul gives the telling of it. And he adds some facts that are new and that are revolutionary in some ways, many ways. He says things in this section of the New Testament that are unheard of in the New Testament. We hear about it from Paul. He interprets, he gives insights. In fact, one of the commentaries I have doesn't know what to make of it. The comments that Paul makes are just so really off the wall and new. They befuddle them. They seem confused. They're unsure of what the interpretation of Paul's perspective is. Strangely, it's again one of the most well-known stories in the Bible. We even had a guest lecturer with the DVD of this episodic event after Sabbath last year. Just I think it was about this time. And it's the Exodus. More specifically, it's the wandering in the desert of Israel after the miracles. That's the title of the message. The subsequent wandering for 40 years in the children of Israel. What exactly happened in those 40 years? Why did it happen? And why is it important? It is indeed important because Paul brings it up, and yes, I'll get to it. He spends a chapter or more on it, and if we believe, as we'll reference, the book of Hebrews, we believe Paul wrote that. Multiple chapters are on this event. He says it is an example. He says it happened because of us or for us. But what are we to make of it? Were the Israelites just pawns in God's hands? Were they just suckers? Bad, wrong time, wrong place, wrong events. What can we learn from them? In fact, when we read Paul's point, we're indeed going to read them in reverse order. So, if you would, please, let's get into our Bibles. Let's read a section that we've read before. Let's understand what happens after the miracles. Turn with me, if you would, to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where we'll spend the vast majority of our time. Verse 1 begins, and these verses are all very, very familiar to you. It says, "Moreover, or for, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea." Now, right there, let's stop, full stop. Verse 1, the word "for" or "moreover," here Paul is alluding to something prior. And we're going to read this backwards. We're going to read chapter 10 first. Paul is alluding to the cloud and passing through the sea. He says all of them did it. After the miracles of the Exodus and the plagues of Egypt, Israel is delivered. The cloud led them to the sea, and they saw another miracle. Then they passed through the Red Sea, all of them, the Yam Suf, the sea of reeds or sea of red. It was a miracle. They also say that they are our fathers, our fathers. Now, we had a very interesting discussion in men's discussion group. Men's discussion group, men's MDG, Miller Genuine Draft. No, men's DG, men's discussion group. And we covered a section in Corinth, and we talked a little bit about the background. Corinth was a Greek city. How many of you have been to Corinth? Well, quite a few of you. It's a fascinating place. It's Mr. Fish is probably about the size of this room. Old Corinth, right? It's not a very big place. The city of Corinth, modern Corinth, was much bigger. Fascinating place, but it was a crossroads, and they have the road still there, laid out. They can't fix the Interstate 10 coming out of San Bernardino to L.A., but the road in Old Corinth still sits there, paved. And so this was a crossroads of civilization. It was a cosmopolitan area, but they were Greek. So when Paul writes the book of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, he's really writing to a group of people who are not usually what we would say Jewish. They may have been Gentile Jews, or they may have been Gentiles and become Jews. We really don't know, but we do know that it was a Greek-speaking audience. Corinth was Greek. And so when he talks to them about our fathers, he's linking these people to the fathers in the books of Exodus and Numbers as their fathers. Not real physical fathers as in a physical family, but as was alluded to in the first message, they are spiritual fathers. Therefore, there is this connection to them, and it's important. So he says, our fathers all were under the cloud, all through the sea. Then he says something very, very interesting. Now, by the way, that's just all verse 1. In verse 2, he starts out with the word again, all. All were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food. All drank the same spiritual drink. And here's another shocker. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. This is unheard of. Now, you and I know this, but more than likely, this is the only time we see, at least in our New Testament, the books that we have, the letters we have of Paul, where he specifies this so clearly. He says, baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Now, baptized unto Moses, cloud and sea, we can't take this too far because it is symbolic, right? A cloud is water vapor. I look this up. I look things up when I don't know the answer. A large nimbus cumulus thunderhead can contain 2 billion pounds of water. Clouds are water vapor. And so there's water content there, obviously. So when he talks about the cloud, he's talking about the cloud that led them to the sea. Then he talks about the sea. The sea is, again, water. So symbolically, he says, they were baptized unto Moses, all of them. All ate the same spiritual food. What's that spiritual food? Manna. And anything they heard, it came from heaven. And we know that Jesus said he is the bread that comes down from heaven. So there's that typology. And all drank the same spiritual drink. Jesus said, come to me, you that wish everlasting life, because I speak with living waters. John chapter 7. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So all the time, Paul says, all the time the Israelites were in the desert, they were with God, and they were baptized, and they were followed. Christ led them. And we understand that, and we know that. We know that angel that followed or that led the Israelites, the angel of Yahweh, we know that was the anthropomorphism, we call it, of Jesus Christ. And this proves it right here. They were with Christ the whole time. They were baptized symbolically. They ate bread, drank water, and there's this eating and drinking analogy. What does that make you think of a high day? There's one high day, or part of a high day, where we eat and drink something very sacred, and that's Passover. And so Paul links all these symbols to the Israelites. But why? So what? Well, it's important. They drank from Christ who followed them, this symbolic language. And it is metaphor. So for after the Exodus, there is miracle after miracle. Why does Paul do this? What's the point here? You may say to yourself, I know this. Then why did Paul bring it up? Because he gives special status and relationship Israel had with God. And many times, we will not look at Israel that way. But indeed, they were chosen. They were a chosen group of people that God would display his power and deliver them as a special people. Now the bad news, verse 5. He says, but with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now, in that one verse describes one of the most agonizing periods in ancient Israel's history. We know that everyone that did not believe of what God was going to be giving them in the promised land, remember, Corinth had to have known this, you know this, uses one sentence that everybody knows. Because of unbelief or disbelief, that generation died in the wilderness, save for a few. Paul almost seems to gloss it over, and I think we know why. With most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies, or they, were scattered and they died. He said, that generation will not see because they did not believe. And that's sad. Paul then gives us the reasons why, and he lists 4 to 5 categories. Surely there are other reasons, but these specifically are 4 to 5. And let's read them. Verse 6, now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. He says, now all these things happened to them as examples, that they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. There's a lot there. Paul goes over stories, and hopefully as the Corinthians did, in your mind's eye, you remember some of them. Let's look at a few of them. He says they're not to lust after evil things. The reference may be in Numbers or Exodus, where they longed for the fish of Egypt. They complained about the fish of Egypt they no longer could enjoy. So God delivered them with what? Manna. He delivered manna to them. So this is a reference to a very powerful miracle. Sexual immorality could be referencing Numbers 25, where the Moabite prostitutes who were nearby were brought into the camp of Israel. That's the sexual immorality. Paul says, don't do that. Very obvious. But number 3 is interesting. It says, nor let us, verse 9, tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. He says, by analogy, that Israel tempted Christ, or by extension, God. How so? And this maybe have to do with Exodus 17 and Numbers 20, and refers possibly to the 2 times of the encounter with Moses and the rock, where this representation of Jesus and the rock. Specific to servants, they're whining again, possibly about why you brought us here. We hate this food. First, we want fish from Egypt. He gives them manna. They like that for a while. Now they hate manna. So in Numbers 21, they say, we hate this food, manna. And the serpents descended. And 23 or 24,000 destroyed Israel. The last one is complaining or grumbling. And God sent the destroyer. This could refer to many issues. The destroyer, the word angel is not there, so it probably doesn't refer to the original Passover. But Israel were known as murmurers. They complained about everything. Now, is complaining a bad thing? Depends on what you're complaining about. Depends on what you're complaining to and to whom. Complaining is often expressed where wrong is made. You complain about a wrong, and you should. Right? How many of you have ever wrote a complaint? All right. How many of you have ever given a bad review on Yelp? Oh, look at the hands shoot up. Yeah, okay. How many gave you a bad review on Amazon.com? It's okay sometimes. It's a justified thing to do. That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is complaining to the wrong person about the wrong thing at the wrong time. You can even complain to the ministry. And you should. You should. But just remember, we're just as human as you are. But this is different. But when you complain, herein is where God is involved and what he had given them through the miracles. They were constantly complaining. They wanted something different, God delivered them. They wanted water, they got it. They wanted different food, they got it. Man, and sometimes quails. They got it. It was never good enough. The bad part was, they complained to Moses, and they complained to Moses. Here's the problem. They trusted Moses. Guess who they didn't trust? They didn't trust God. So they went to their human leader, and so they complained. They were delivered from Egypt. They were given manna and quail and water. It says through Paul, they were led by Christ to a new land. They had direct contact with God. And they complained. And they didn't complain. They didn't complain to God because they didn't trust him. They didn't believe God. Paul gives a detailed account of how people called by God for very special reasons, by the power of God, can miss the mark. And with many, it cost them their life. But here he gives specifics for a very specific reason. They suffered this loss as an example. An example, Paul says, to us. I don't think it means that Israel suffered for us. In other words, we will make these people suffer so these people that read in Corinth understand. But let's read verse 6 and then verse 11. Now these things that were said before and will be said after became our examples to the intent we should not do what they did. Verse 11, now he bookends it and says, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. They were written down for all time. If I was an Israelite wandering around for 40 years, do you think I'd want that written? I don't think so, especially why I had to wander for 40 years. But it was written, and we can read it. And Paul says it's important that you understand it. And he gives reasons why in a minute. It is for us so that when we read, we understand. Paul then takes the next few verses in stages. It has been said that verse 12 and 13 are some of the most important statements in the entire New Testament when it talks about the human condition. It says, therefore. Whenever you see a therefore, or a moreover, or a for, it's a specific Greek word. It means, based on what we have talked about, therefore, we conclude. He says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Take heed, beware, warning. Warning, let he who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Because no temptation has overcome or overtaken you except as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. The word is you. This was written for you. And he also says, you should take warning after reading this of he who thinks he stands, lest he fall. Standing is good, falling not so good. Let he who thinks he understands take heed, lest he who thinks he knows beware, lest he fall. This is important because it speaks to a human trait that we are all infected with. This verse in 12 says arrogance. Arrogance, the lack of humility. It is for us that we're to understand this. It also says, because of what we've read, it speaks to a number of things. It says, beware of looking at other people. It says, beware of judging other people, their sins, their faults. There's no there here. There's a you. It's easier to say of the Israelites, and I've heard this or read this, basically, quote unquote, Israel, bunch of losers. They failed. I mean, wow, epic fail. Well, they didn't have God's Spirit. Well, brethren, I believe they did. I believe they did. That is how huge this is. This is how important this is. I believe indeed that they were God's chosen people. They were not the part-time team. They were God's epic team. And I believe God has a future yet for them. Excuse me. Matthew 23, verse 30, if you want to turn there, we can. I'm going to quote it for you. It is in red in my Bible, and that's mucho importante, right? Very important. It's in red because guess who said it is in red? Harry the plumber? No, if it's in red, it means Jesus Christ said it. He said to them, and you say, if we had lived in the days of our ancestors, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Well, if I'd been there, if I'd have been in Israel, wandering through the desert, I would have been one of the believers. Sure you would. Sure you would. How many people do we estimate were wandering at the time that the spies went into the land and then came back with a not so good report, or a good report, depending on how you look at it? There were thousands and thousands and thousands of Israelites who didn't believe. It was wholesale unbelief. It was tragic, of epic proportion. And very few were allowed in from that generation. Let's read it again. I think this is a warning that Matthew gives us from the lips of Jesus Christ. And if you say, and you say, if we had lived in the days of our ancestors, we would not have let this happen. Because we're better than they are. This is the fault that many people get into. We judge other people by their sins and not our own. Yeah, sure. We're so righteous. We're so gifted. We're so sanctimonious. And this is what Paul tells all of us. What you experience, as sad as it may be, and there are sad, sad situations. We hear of them every week. I know the ministers and deacons get the prayer requests, and some of the requests for prayers from all over the world are just tragic. We'd never get through the service if I recounted some of them to you. They're unbelievable. But Paul says in a very interesting way, I find this fascinating, verse 13, no temptation, no issue has overtaken you except as is common to man. There's nothing new. There really isn't. A financial reversal? Somebody may say, wow, that's new. That's different. I've never seen that before. No, it's just a variation of a theme. Or that illness, someone may say, wow, never seen that. That's a mutation. That's going to be a rough one. May not get over that. Or to that relationship disaster that someone is in. Wow, this is really, really complicated. This has to be first time ever. No, Paul says, no temptation that has overcome you or overtaken mankind, as sad as it may be. And again, many of them are very sad and tragic. And that isn't to lessen them. But Paul does this for a reason. He says it for a reason. He says it because I think sometimes we say these things, it's different, it's new. What I've had happen to me or what this person says, it's different. We say that to avoid the obvious in our arrogance or in mankind's arrogance. We don't know what to do. We just don't know what to do. And that is true. But then it's okay because it's new. It's different. No one's faced what I've faced. No one's experienced what I've experienced. Yes, they have. We just don't know about them. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we share with one another, and indeed, these situations are so similar, they seem to be almost the same. Paul says it's happened before. It's happened thousands and thousands of times. If it happened, Paul says it in Corinthians, and it's in the first century AD, that was 2,000 years ago. So if it happened before, nothing is not common to man. It's even more so. It's all happened before, over and over again. There is nothing that has not happened before. You or a friend may say to you, wow, tough break. Don't think that's fixable. Ooh, if I were you, I'd declare bankruptcy. Just get it over with. Wow, you must have really sinned a doozy. And by doing so, we judge. We compare. And Paul says no one should be doing that. Paul tells us in verse 12 that God is faithful. Let's read it. He says, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. It doesn't say that you may be able to solve it. When I look back, and you may do the same, when I look back on some of the real crazy spots over the last 4 or 5, because I've been referenced that I am so ancient, over the many, many centuries of my life, I don't think I solved anything. I tried to bear it. I don't think I truly solved it. I withstood it, hopefully. And I think that's the analysis that we need to make. And this is what Paul is telling us. You endure it. It's not insurmountable. You endure it. It may not result in the way that you wanted. Few things do. It's not what you expected. It's on YouTube. It's not what you expected. Few things are. But God says he is faithful. And that's important. He is faithful. By comparison, mankind, not so faithful. Israel, not so faithful, unfortunately. He says to basically look at ourselves, to look at the mote we think that is in our eye, when in essence it's an 18-foot-long 4x4 in our eye. He says to look at that first, to take care of that first, because with God we work together through the situation. That's what he's saying. The parallels to Israel are inescapable. And that is why Paul uses this. They had miracles. So have we. They were baptized into a belief and understanding. So have we. Christ has fed them, protected them, as with us. They succumbed to disbelief. We could as well. But, he says, yet God is ever faithful. God never left them. God never stopped protecting them. So, he says, do not compare yourself, lest you fall. Paul then shifts gears, same transmission. He's just changing gears. He's using the same transmission. And he says in the next few verses about other people and how we're to relate to them. So in verse 14, if you'll turn there. Now what I'm going to do is something a little different. I'm going to read this, and I'm going to try, very, very difficult, but I'm going to try and read this without a running commentary. Because after what we've just read about Israel and how we should respond and how God is with us, I want to continue because he uses that very interesting word, therefore. I want you to know two things, though. He uses sacrificed meat in the marketplace. It's difficult to parallel. I was in Stater Brothers recently. I was allowed to by Becky. That's where she goes. And I said, can I come along too? She said, okay. So I got to go to Stater Brothers. And I went to the beef section. I looked. I promise you I did. Some of them looked like they'd been through a pagan sacrifice. I'm not sure what they were. They were very expensive. But Paul's analogy, when he uses these analogies, we need to transmit it to 21st century lingo, right? So my point is, we don't deal with meat sacrificed to idols. I hope you don't anyway. Hope you don't. So we translate it into what we understand today. We are not talking about doctrinal issues. We are talking about a cultural local custom. An aspect. This is not talking about the Sabbath or the holy days or beliefs in clean or unclean. It's as it relates to meat sacrificed to Baal or Molech or some regional deity. The second thing is to note the word therefore. And that means from what we learned before. When you see the word therefore, remember what we've talked about. Verse 14. Therefore, my beloved, free from idolatry, I speak as to wise men. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not communion of the body of Christ? For though we are many, we are one bread and one body, and we all partake of that one bread. Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partakers of the altar? What am I saying then? That an idol is anything? Or what is offered idols is anything? Rather, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. and I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things truly edify. Paul says within the context of the law, these things are lawful for me. And he's speaking about meat and sacrifices. He says, let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Verse 25, eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's and its fullness. If any of those who do not believe invite you to dinner, and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience sake. Remember, this is not about clean and unclean. This is specifically focused upon a local cultural issue. But if anyone say to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you, and for conscience sake, for the earth is the eternal's in all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? For if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for the food over which I give thanks? Therefore, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. Very little comment. Paul is speaking to you and to me. He said so in the first part of the chapter. This was written for our example. He is not talking about meat sacrificed to idols. Not to us. If Paul could write to us now, what example would he give of being aware of other people, being conscious of other people and their sensitivities? What would he say? In fact, I imagine with so many people here, each of us would interpret it a little different. But it says the same thing. We all have been in those situations where we've been around other people. He says, you stand alone, but you're part of your community, both inside the church and outside the church. You need to be aware. And don't think too highly of yourself, lest you fall. He says, remember, Israel after the flesh. That's another example. We've read backwards chapter 10 because there's something that went before. If you'll turn with me, chapter 10, by most commentaries, is a reference from beginning in chapter 8. And you will see some of the same themes in chapter 8 that we read about in chapter 10. Now, once again, if you'll turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 8, we're going to read, and again, I'm going to have very little comment, because I think the words, if we truly believe that the epistles of Paul are part of the New Testament and they are inspired by God in their original, which we do not have, and that they are applicable to us, then as we read this together, I want you to apply it in your own situation. I'm not going to tell you what it should apply to. You each and every one of you have your own conscience. Now let's read chapter 8. Now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge, however, puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing, yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him, God. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. Now, this is very interesting. Side comment. That an idol is nothing in this world, and that there is no other God but one. Verse 5. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords — that's a different subject for a different time, he's admitting that there is — yet for us, there is one God the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some with consciousness of the idol, until now it is as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest someone, somehow, this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren, and he does call it that, and would wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, replace the word food with anything your heart and your mind and God's Spirit decides. Replace it. Therefore, if X makes my brother stumble, I will never eat X again, lest I make my brother stumble. It is an interesting parallel that Paul uses at the central point of chapter 8. Chapter 9, he talks about a pattern of self-denial. It's not that germane. Paul does this. He'll speak about one subject, skip it, and then return to that subject. And he does so here in chapters 8 and 10. But he uses Israel as the kind of the leverage, as the central point, as the example. It's something that he felt that the church at Corinth knew. We're like Corinth. I think I and others have made the analogy, if anybody could identify with the church at Corinth, it is the church at First Californians, or the First Angelinos. We're a very cosmopolitan society, unlike anywhere else in the world, I think you would agree. But he uses Israel as the example. Poor, poor Israel is always picked on as the example. I don't think God's done with Israel. But let me ask another question as we conclude. Who is Israel? Who are they? Paul says in many ways, it's anyone of God's people, especially of former times. He says, because you can relate to this, because they are our fathers. They are our predecessors in the faith. He says, do we judge them with arrogance? Well, then who are we? We are sinners who have been forgiven. In fact, too much, we have been forgiven much. These verses that Paul gives us in, especially 1 Corinthians 10, are a reminder about Israel, about the rich heritage and history that we picture in type, prototype, of all the holy days. Israel is trapped in the history of all the holy days. There's not a one of them that they aren't connected to in some way. So it has great relevance to us. So we learn from the mistakes that they made. Paul reminds us about Israel. We must remember that God chose Israel. They are not some poor, weak people who should be pitied. They had a chapter of their life that they didn't do so well and didn't believe, but they are still considered the very apple of his eye. They are still a part of his heritage. And we indeed are like Israel because they're our example. We were baptized. We were chosen, just as the people of Israel were, as Paul tells us. But Paul reminds us to beware and to take note, to remind ourselves not to judge others, but to concentrate on the wonderful gifts that we have been given. Because just as they were baptized, as were we, they had God with them. God never left them. God never forsook them. The pillar of the fire and the cloud, all the miracles throughout the wanderings, God never failed to protect Israel. and on into Canaan, and on into Israel's history later through the series of kings and judges, God was with Israel. I think it's a lesson for us that Paul tries to put across, that God is also with us. He will never, ever give us a temptation or a trial that we may not succeed in eliminating, but that we will always succeed in bearing. So I think at this time, and I noted that Mr. Budge said we're kind of in holiday season, shouldn't we always be kind of in a holiday season, moving transition from one to another? We're already talking about the fall holidays. And those fall holidays, they speak of Israel. They speak of this family that we're a part of. That we have a family within the church, we have an extension of family, and we also have the world. And in each and every case, we are to be aware of our surroundings. We're to be aware of how we speak to one another and how we speak to the world. But we should never, ever forget that God is always with us. He has always been with us, and he will be always with us.